Hey, a win is a win is a win, and it was an exciting one at that as the Sixers take care of business in game one of the NBA playoffs. It is the Sixers Talk Podcast. So glad you could join us. We're brought to you by Wilmington University, WilmU Works, Noah Levick, our NBC Sports Philadelphia.com Sixers writer here with us as we dissect what happened here this past Sunday. It was, man, the MVP chants, the Westbrook sucks chants. It was the fans were back in the building, which made an incredible difference. Noah, you were there. Curious, just first and foremost, to get your opinion on the electricity in the building on Sunday.
Very high level of electricity and juice in that building. Very hard to believe it was only 10,000-ish fans. It was interesting that there were like large chunks at the top of the arena where no one was sitting, which I think helped add to the impression that it was far higher than 50% capacity. But yeah, ton of noise, ton of energy. And you could just tell a lot of folks who have been waiting for this moment for a long time. I mean, we talked about it, I guess, recently, that the last, you know, Sixers home playoff experience was in 2019, you know, won the series against Brooklyn. And then their last home playoff game was a game six win over Toronto. So really cool to see all the energy in that building, and the fans had an exciting afternoon, as you alluded to. Tons of ups and downs and unexpected twists and turns in this game, which is everything you hope for game one of the playoffs.
Yeah, man. It was one moment when Seth Curry hit that three in transition late in the game where my daughter jumped up off the couch and was screaming, and she likes to scream a lot watching the game, which is always fun to watch. But she jumped up at that moment, and I got the vibe from that moment and the chills from that moment. So in watching the fans react, my comment to her was like, that's worth the price of admission right there. Like, if you pay your ticket and get a feeling and excitement like that, that's all you're going for and hoping for. And there were tons of those moments. It's like the adversity, like you mentioned, is kind of like, you kind of need the adversity to kind of overcome it and be like the great plot, the actual plot ending that you want to get those climaxes in between. But not to belabor the point, fans could not have expected, though, Noah, to come to the game and see Tobias Harris turn into Allen Iverson and put the team on his back with 28 points in the first half, a stretch of where he scored 16 of the Sixers' points, all of them coming from his hands. What was that like, witnessing that in person for you? Because, you know, we're watching Tobias, you know, start the game hot, and he just carried it through the first half, even missing some makeable shots in that stretch as well. He could have had even better numbers as he attempted to go for 30. I believe he got the last shot of the first half as well. What was your impression there as Tobias just went straight coconuts, bananas, bonkers there in the first half?
Yeah, I just say the personal experience was a big adjustment, having that many fans back in the building, just in terms of like my day. And you remember, you know, what it was kind of like in the before times, and trying to sort of focus and laser in on what's actually happening on the court with this pandemonium around you. But really welcome to have that in the building. Yeah, I think no one expected that. I agree with that assessment. And of course, he understood that he needed to step up once Joel Embiid got into foul trouble and was the last starter on the floor with four bench players. And that group squandered a 10-point Sixers lead. And I think that's when you maybe felt a little bit of anxiety in the building and amongst the Sixers, you know, not having their MVP candidate out there and needing to rely on Tobias Harris. And he was brilliant. I mean, I think at his best, he either has a, you know, agility edge, or he has a physical strength edge. And it felt like, honestly, whoever matched up against him yesterday, that was the case. I thought the Sixers did very well at screening for him and getting him, you know, advantageous switches against smaller players. He did an awesome job of attacking those. he was great, you know, blowing by Rui Hachimura. And as you said, he was just in a complete zone. And credit to Doc Rivers and the Sixers for recognizing that and riding the hot hand. And 28 first half points is a brilliant effort on his part. And the Sixers were still down a point. Like, they needed him, you know, to stay in that game and give themselves a chance to win it in the second half. And they, you know, managed to pull that off.
We did a Sixers title run special before the playoffs started, me, Amy Fadul, and Mark Jackson. One of the questions that was posed was, does Tobias Harris need to ratchet his game up for the postseason? And my response to that was like, no, he doesn't need to ratchet it up. He just needs to continue doing what he's doing at an even more efficient clip. So, I mean, the efficiency was there in the first half. I can't remember what the numbers were. I think it was 12 for 17 in the first half, but I could be wrong. But
yeah.
Okay.
Excellent.
Okay. Yeah. All right. So, but he ends up 15 for 29. Like, you would take that every night for him to come out like that and take on a scoring load, even if Joel is out on the floor. But to be that efficient, like, you see him coming out hot like that, like, you can't help but get him the basketball. So I just think him answering the bell in that way was just, man, it was a sight to see. You almost, it was a little bit surreal. Like, you know, you had all this noise and interaction going on, which hadn't been the case for you covering the Sixers games throughout the season. So it was an adjustment. It was just an adjustment seeing Tobias being as dominant as he was, because, and it wasn't like he was doing anything out of the ordinary that we hadn't seen or out of the realm of the offense or the flow of the game. It was just him just, you know, picking his spots, knowing, like you said, when to use the strength and when to use the finesse, depending on who, or speed or what have you, depending on who was guarding him. I know a few times Davis Bertans was a lamb for the slaughter. A couple of times it was Ish Smith or whoever else was switched out onto him. But part of the reason he had to go off, which you mentioned, was the fact that Joel Embiid picks up these fouls where, you know, the second one with the elbow where we thought Doc Rivers challenged it, but he ended up not challenging it. I thought that was an offensive foul. I wouldn't have challenged it because once you slow it down, it looks worse. You know what I'm saying? Like, in the speed of the game, you probably could be like, ah, that wasn't, what are you talking about? But once you slow it down, you see the kind of the, you know, Alex Len, you know, taking the blow and his arm going down from the elbow, which opens up the opportunity for Joel to spin and get to the basket. You kind of see it a little more obvious. But did you feel like Doc should have challenged at any of those points with the Joel fouls, or were you okay with how it progressed just from, you know, your perspective?
Yeah, the second one, I had a similar reaction to you where it's like, that's a normal basketball play. That's something that happens in the course of the game. And in real time, you don't bat an eye at it until you realize, oh, wait, the official has called that an offensive foul. And then, as you say, you look at it on replay and it's a call that, you know, most likely would stand. You know, there's a decent barrier for what would overturn a call. I guess you could say maybe you could have tried it on the third foul, and that would have been, you know, a high impact challenge if he gets it right. I believe it was 7:07 left in the first half. So that's could have gotten Joel Embiid, you know, seven extra minutes in this game. But it's tough with challenges, I think, because, you know, obviously you're very limited. And I think most coaches, the strategy is to save it until very late because you don't know if officials are going to make a very costly mistake late in the game. And you know that Doc Rivers, if it's a close game and the officials blow a call late and he doesn't have his challenge, everyone is going to be furious about that fact. So I'm empathetic toward that kind of situation that he's in just because of the way these rules work. So I don't personally have any gripes with how he managed the situation, but, you know, it's a tough spot he's in. I thought the officials in general, you could tell early in the game that it was going to be a little caught a little more tightly than the typical postseason game. And in some ways that benefited Joel Embiid. You know, he got 13 free throw attempts. The Wizards trio of centers, they all accumulated, you know, their fair share of fouls early in that game. But, you know, the bottom line is Embiid getting in foul trouble is something that tends to have a very devastating impact on the Sixers. And that was the case yesterday. You know, Dwight Howard was a negative impact player, and the Sixers really were only able to stay in this game and kind of weather that storm because, as we mentioned, Tobias Harris was simply incredible. So tip of the cap to him for stepping up, you know, in that situation where they very much needed him to.
Yeah, you mentioned Joel and his 13 free throws. Some credit needs to be given to Joel that even with these three fouls, early fouls he picks up, and he has to sit, and I think he only played 10 minutes, was it, in the first half? Or something to that, yeah, something to that effect. Yep. So, but he still ends up a plus 20. He still ends up with 30 points. He still has an efficient 9-16 shooting night with those 13 trips to the free throw line, which I was actually surprised by just the way the game was officiated. You know, we'll talk a little bit more officiating a bit later, but Coach Lynam, Jim Lynam, was asked on the pregame show from Amy Fadul if he thought that, you know, Joel obviously led the league in free throw attempts during the season, if he would be make less trips to the line in the playoffs. And he said, or would it be more of the same? And he said he'll probably make less trips to the line because the whistles won't be as tight, which will be, you know, it's playoff basketball. It's intense. It's a little more physical. Few more things get let go. But it was the opposite of that in the first half. And whatever the calls the refs may have missed or didn't miss, as far as the fouls were concerned, the whistle was tight as far as reach-ins and, you know, blocks or charges or what have you. But that surprised me. But credit to Joel, man. Ends up a plus 20, you know, with 30 points. And, you know, the rebounds and whatnot, you know, you got to attribute to his lack of time on the floor. As far as the other numbers, but, you know, for obviously their game plan was to slow him down on his very first bucket of the game. They ran a double team at him and he hit the one-legged fadeaway. And that was obviously their game plan, was to force him to get other people involved. And Tobias Harris said, you know what? I got it. We'll figure this out. And without him, where would they have been? You know what I'm saying?
Absolutely. Yeah. My impression just watching the game in real time was that he handled the double teams very well. It seemed like kind of a popular approach was sending the man, you know, on the near side baseline and sort of forcing him to spin out of that, you know, toward the middle of the floor, or, you know, perhaps forcing a turnover. So my initial impression was that he did a great job. He did end up with 5 turnovers, you know, which is not so great. But the Sixers as a team winning the turnover battle, you know, 16-11, a key factor in winning this game. And I have to say, I trying to imagine just how extreme the transition defense issues would have been if they were even worse with the turnovers, because their transition defense in the first half was poor. And as I said, it wasn't coming off the turnovers. There were even 2 plays, one from Ish Smith and one from Russell Westbrook, where off of the Sixers make, a Wizards ball handler just sprinted down the middle of the floor uninterrupted for a layup. And that can't happen. And I think it's not what you want to see after a week where transition defense was a point of emphasis, and they had, you know, 4 opportunities to practice it, and then it was very subpar, you know, out of the gates, albeit improved in the second half of the game, but a sign of encouragement for the Wizards that they were able to push the pace and beat the Sixers down the floor and, you know, create miscommunications. And the Sixers, you know, had a lot of miscues with their transition D, and that's, you know, something the Wizards can take away from game 2 and think maybe we have a shot in this series if we just push that pace and maybe do a little better job of forcing turnovers and have that, you know, fuel our offense.
Angie's List is now Angie, and we've heard a lot of theories about why.
I thought it was an eco move.
your words, less paper.
No, it was so you could say it faster.
No, it's to be more iconic.
Must be a tech thing.
But those aren't quite right. It's because now you can compare upfront prices, book a service instantly, and even get your project handled from start to finish.
Sounds easy.
It is, and it makes us so much more than just a list. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I. Or download the app today.
Achieving a gorgeous grin from home isn't a total mystery with BiteClear aligners. Just don't be surprised if all of your sleuthing friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. BiteClear aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Start college, build skills, and complete your degree with Wilmington University. 100% online options and affordable tuition makes WilmU work for you. Learn more at wilmu.edu.
Man, Joel Embiid was not on the floor as much as the Sixers would have liked, and his numbers suffered for it. He ended up with 30 points, partly due to him taking 13 free throws, but picking up the rebounding slack. And in fact, the only double-digit rebounder, Dwight Howard, comes into the game early in the first quarter, kind of throwing off his rhythm of, you know, the energy and impact he brings on the glass. But Mr. Ben Simmons with 15 rebounds to go with 15 assists, becoming just the sixth player in NBA history with those type of numbers. And we saw him facilitating. We saw him with the transition game. My God, that dime to George Hill was on a rope. It was such a peppery dime from Ben. George had to double clutch it to catch that thing. But, man, it was a beautiful chest pass from him. And, maybe only a few people in the league can do that the way, you know, Ben does it. But all that being said, just magnifying how prolific he is and the impact he has in the game. But there is the yin to the yang where he only has 6 points in the game, 3 for 9 from the floor. We saw a beautiful bucket early in the game when he had Westbrook, I believe it was, in the post. He goes to the baby hook. But, you know, outside of that, it wasn't much, you know, beauty to the offense for him. 0 for 6 from the free throw line. There was a stretch where him and Dwight Howard went 1 for 4 from the stripe in a weird sequence. It's just how do you balance, Noah, what you saw from Ben and his rebounding and assists, but you don't get quite the same, you know, production on the offensive end? Does it do you have to even pay attention to that, considering that they won and he was so, you know, dynamite in other ways? Or how does that rub off on you? How do you look at that?
Yeah, the way I think about it is he is incredibly unique. Doc Rivers said, you know, you just don't see people with that skill set in the NBA. Draymond Green, I guess, is one person who comes to mind sort of in that broad category of it's recognized that he's extremely valuable even when he doesn't score a lot, you know, most of the time. And I think this game was the epitome of that idea that Ben Simmons can and often is super integral to the Sixers' success without scoring. Now, would he be better and would the Sixers be better if he scored more and he shot more and made more shots, you know, outside of the paint? Absolutely. Like, I think that's, you know, a no-brainer observation. But I think he's many things at once, and his package is one that folks are just not familiar with, especially in the context of he is an all-star player, and especially in today's NBA where scoring is so rampant and offense is kind of the name of the game, is rare to see an all-star whose best qualities, scoring would be pretty low down the list, and shooting would most definitely be his primary weakness. 0 for 6 at the line in particular, like, there's no way to spin that. That's very bad. And he was 53.3% on his free throws after the All-Star break. So it's not like it's coming out of nowhere. Like, you know, on a normal day, he's a mediocre at best, you know, free throw shooter, and 0-for-6. Okay. It's not a normal day and you'd expect things to improve, but for your primary ball handler to not be a good free throw shooter and to have recently regressed at the line when it looked like maybe he was going to improve a little bit, you know, on his free throws this year, that is a bit of a concern. No way around that. But Doc Rivers called him special. I personally agree with that. I think 15 rebounds, including a career high 8 offensive rebounds, 15 assists, including 5 of the Sixers' 10 three-point assists, and very excellent defense on Bradley Beal. You know, Beal was 1-for-6 with 3 turnovers when guarded by Simmons. I think all of that is undoubtedly extremely positive and shouldn't, you know, be seen as irrelevant in light of him having a poor shooting game. You know, it's all relevant. He brings a ton of things to the table, much of it very good. And, you know, we saw, I think, the peak version of Ben Simmons, the extremely valuable player who doesn't score as much as the typical All-Star in game one.
Yeah. You would think, though, him playing in that dunker spot, like he had that ferocious dunk, another moment where my daughter was up off the couch. As was I, but he had that ferocious dunk and just being around the basket to pick up, you know, he had 6 points, you know, he could pick up a couple more putbacks, like something. But, you know, when you win, of course, there's no, you know, winning is a great deodorant, as the saying goes. So there's really nothing really to harp on necessarily. But, you know, and I'm not trying to, you know, predict things like this, but there will be games where the numbers might be similar, where they could have used his impact. They could have used him being more assertive. And I think that's the thing, is like, he's not even being assertive offensively. Like we've seen, like, you know, we can go to that Utah game over and over again, but just be more aggressive, you know, getting to the basket, using his advantages, which I thought we would get more of. Like I, you know, mentioned that bucket he had on Westbrook in the post, you know, particularly with Joel in foul trouble. But Tobias obviously shouldered that load, so they didn't need him. But just one of those things where, you know, I was on with Ty Johnson on Saturday on, you know, 97.5 The Fanatic for the Ty Johnson show, and I appreciate him having me on. But there is, both things can exist at the same time, where Ben is tremendously effective and important and vital to what the Sixers do and earns every bit of that $100 million plus contract that he makes, but also can coexist the fact that he could do a little more. He could be a little more efficient from the line, of course. He could be a little more assertive offensively. Those things aren't mutually exclusive. They can coexist at the same time. And I think this, like you said, is the epitome of what Ben Simmons is, where you get just the prolific, you know, jaw-dropping moments. And, you know, just things that you would not see normally in an NBA game or in a basketball game, period, if a player like him of that ilk, you know, like you said, maybe Draymond Green. I like Rajon Rondo is a good example. Obviously, the big size difference, but just somebody who impacts the game, doesn't score, but, you know, sets up and creates so much opportunity for everyone. But those things can coexist is what I'm saying. So all in all, you'll take it every night if you got a guy like that, you know, impacting the game in that way, because you're going to win on nights like that. It probably won't be many losses if he's coming out and doing that. But, you know, if he finishes the game, you know, 4-for-8, like, what are you going to say? And he ends up with 8 points and takes, you know, makes one shot, misses one less shot. Like, you know, I don't know. It's just you can't. I think from an outsider's perspective, someone who might not watch Ben every night or don't see him as often, or, you know, doesn't pay attention to the box score as much, this can be extremely frustrating and confusing and be worth a Bleacher Report post, or, you know, not to mention them, or just like some national syndication making a post about, oh, he finally took a jump shot, or look at this. He shot a three, which he did in this game, that shot that looked really bad. But, you could make that inference, but for someone who watches him every night, I think it's just like, you've accepted it by now. You have to, because this is who he is, right?
At least right now, and in some ways, I will say,
like, the other stuff is an outlier. When you see him shoot the fadeaways, right, and when you see him be really aggressive, that's the outlier stuff, right?
Certainly, the jump, anything involving jump shooting is
anything involving jump shot. We can agree easily.
Outlier and not something be expected. I'd agree that him being like ultra aggressive is outside of the norm. Maybe outlier is like a little bit too strong of a term, mm-hmm. but I think that's fair. I will say, yesterday, like in games where he's not scoring the ball particularly well, that often coincides with him just being very peripheral in general, and just, as you said, maybe hanging out in the dunker spot or just giving the ball up early in possession and not doing much from there. And it often coincides with him being loose with his decision-making and careless with the ball and sort of desperate to push the ball, and then that leading to turnovers. Neither of those things was the case yesterday. Like, he only turned the ball over two times, and obviously an assist to two turnovers is an incredible ratio. And 8 offensive rebounds is his career high. So it wasn't a situation, and we've even seen that sometimes, like when he's in a zone, you know, he's facing a zone defense, and that leads him to just not be very effective as a primary ball handler. And like Brett Brown mentioned last year, the most, key way he can be of help to us against a zone is with his offensive rebounding. He can be like a Enes Kanter or Kenneth Faried, and I think those names being associated with Ben Simmons kind of struck some people as ridiculous. But it's true, as we saw yesterday, that this is someone who, because of.
But I think as a number one pick, though, it also makes it like you're comparing him to like Draymond Green, who was, you know, picked, you know, way down into the second round. You know what I'm saying? So,
yeah, the way it was framed, I can understand people having a gut negative reaction to that. But the way I heard those comments, and the reason they continue to stick with me, is just the basic idea of, this is someone who has all the tools to be a great offensive rebounder. And that's very much what he was yesterday in a playoff game. And if he can be that, you know, down the road during this playoff run for the Sixers, that's huge. You know, extra possessions are extremely important, obviously, in the playoffs. And he's someone who can secure those for the Sixers. So the lack of scoring, at least for the Sixers yesterday, it did not also go along with some of the other negative things that it typically does for Ben Simmons.
Fun player to watch, man. Nothing you can't say. You can't take that away from him. I enjoy watching him play. We'll get into Wednesday a little bit but I just will be curious to see the adjustments that Scott Brooks makes, particularly, like you said, with the transition defense. And you saw him trying to push the tempo and wanting the guys to push the tempo in the early going to take advantage of that. The adjustments they make will be interesting come Wednesday.
For sure. Yeah, I mean, that's what Washington does. You know, they had the fastest pace in the league. They ran transition possessions, you know, I believe the second most in the league. That's where they're at their best, and the Sixers are a great half-court defense, so you want to minimize the time you go against that defense. So I think that will be a emphasized part of the game plan for Washington throughout the series. The one adjustment I'm curious if he's going to make is, like, does he play Daniel Gafford more? Because Daniel Gafford was great.
Quick. Yeah.
And having a bright spot for them, and is agile and, you know, super athletic and runs the floor. He's great at that.
Alex Lynn got Joel in foul trouble, though. He was the one that kind of precipitated that as well. So,
sure.
So you'd say Robin Lopez is the odd man out, is what you're saying?
I'm not sure there's an odd man out. I just wonder if we see Gafford's minutes go up to the, you know, that he's the center who plays, you know, the highest share of minutes amongst that trio. That would make a lot of sense to me. And that's one adjustment that I'd personally be curious to see. But Washington's bench, you know, they only went nine deep, but, you know, did a nice job in this game. Bertans had that stretch where he hit a couple threes in that second quarter, you know, so that's something I'm curious to see, just whether Brooks makes any adjustments with kind of how he divvies up those minutes, and whether Gafford is featured a little bit more.
You talk about divvying up minutes. We have another topic to get to, but since you mentioned that, let's look at what Doc Rivers did a little bit. Go 11 guys on mm-hmm. the floor, which was much more typical to regular season. You know, we talk all this, have talked about playoff rosters tightening up and who's not going to see the floor. The game dictated that, hey, Tyrese Maxey needs to get out there when Seth Curry goes to the locker room. Joel Embiid's in foul trouble. I got to play Dwight Howard sooner than I would have liked. So he's going with the flow, which you got to be, you know, okay with that, because he made the right moves and put the, you know, Tyrese Maxey comes in and gets an and one in short order, crossing Ish Smith over pretty nasty. You got to like the adjustments he made considering Joel's early foul trouble.
I think for the most part, it's hard to gauge kind of what exactly the plan was, as you mentioned, because of the foul trouble. I mean, the one thing I'd say is Dwight Howard just playing as many minutes as he did. Maybe you could have some qualms with that. And perhaps this is one of those situations where you consider other options at center, such as Ben Simmons, you know, as I've personally thought might be a decent idea in these sorts of spots. But yeah, Tyrese Maxey, great instant impact, someone who's always ready to go. And that was certainly a bright spot. George Hill played very well, I think, was the, you know, the Sixers best bench player yesterday. I was interested also to see that Furkan Korkmaz got a shot, just because I think my read of that situation was no one could make a three, and Doc Rivers figured maybe Furkan would be that guy, which was not the case.
He was not that guy.
he was not. He had good looks, but everything was coming up short for him, unfortunately, yesterday. But look, they've got options off the bench. They played, you know, the fact that they could play 11, and that was reasonable to do, I think is encouraging. And we'll see. We'll get a better read on things, I think, moving forward, you know, assuming foul trouble isn't an issue in future games.
Wanted to get your take on Danny Green guarding Russell Westbrook. Shout out to Coach Skip on Twitter and Instagram. He and I were having a back and forth, and he felt like Danny Green not being quick enough to slow down Westbrook was really causing havoc for the Sixers in the paint, where, you know, you're not stopping the point of attack, and that would be a better job for Matisse Thybulle with that regard. As soon as he said that, Danny Green got like those two like weird plays where he banged it off of Westbrook's knee and then like forced that steal or turnover or charge or whatever it was on Westbrook. So it was funny, but I thought that was a great observation, because we see Matisse Thybulle come in the game and disrupt Bradley Beal, but I didn't see him on Westbrook as much. What'd you think about that observation and the fact that maybe that's a game two adjustment the Sixers could make, is maybe slowing down the point of attack a bit?
Yeah, I think Danny Green, as far as just the approach against Russell Westbrook, it was solid. Like, he's
a
guy that recognizes, you know, you want Russell Westbrook to take mid-range jumpers, and he's quite frankly happy.
My God, was Russ trying to bank those in? Like, what? Some of those shots were so
hard to tell. But no, I think Matisse Thybulle, like we were just talking about the Sixers rotations, there's a case that he should be playing a lot more than 14 minutes in a series like this, where the opposition has two dangerous backcourt players. You know, if he's only going to play 14 minutes, then the Sixers are pretty limited in what they can do. But in theory, I'm open to that idea of him getting more time against Westbrook, because obviously Ben Simmons did a nice job on Bradley Beal, and the Sixers feel decent about that particular matchup. So sure, I mean, I would be all for playing Thybulle 20 plus minutes. But then again, it's a situation where you worry about his minutes when he's sharing the floor with Dwight Howard. And as I said, I think there's also a case to not be playing Dwight Howard quite as much. And again, of course, you know, with foul trouble, you would think that Dwight Howard would be playing less, you know, throughout the series.
Danny Green, kind of an unsung hero, pretty efficient, a plus 15, 11 points, 4 of 6 from the floor, 3 for 4 from three. Couple him with George Hill as another veteran presence. Obviously, Danny Green coming off back-to-back championship title runs. George Hill with 15 years of experience, you know, it's just like a, you know, another example of positive impact on the roster from Morey and Rivers or whoever you want to, Belton Brand, who's pulling the strings as far as those decisions are made. To definitely, you know, with Tobias Harris, you know, veteran presences that really, you know, pay dividends.
Especially with Hill, the patience with him looks like it is paying off and will pay off. You know, I think there was probably some consternation among Sixers fans when it took a while for Hill to debut and people were wondering exactly what was going on with the injury and whether he'd be healthy for the playoffs or, you know, what exactly his status would be. But I think you see, he's a very smart basketball player. He's versatile and sturdy defensively. He's someone you can trust late in games. And he's someone who has played in a ton of big games. Danny Green and, you know, another person in that same category. Credit to the Sixers front office for making the move for him at the trade deadline. Looks like it's a smart one.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
We are driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/match. Just go to Indeed.com/match right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/match. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Start college, build skills, and complete your degree with Wilmington University. 100% online options and affordable tuition makes WilmU work for you. Learn more at wilmu.edu.
Speaking of consternation among Sixers fans, man, we delved into the officiating, obviously, with Joel Embiid's foul trouble, but people were letting their voices be heard, as you might expect from Sixers people, Philly sports people, because it was obviously the foul calls on Joel Embiid, whether they were ticky-tacky or what have you, but coupled with the lack of calls – well, I guess it really the lack of calls where it comes to traveling, but man, what a tough call comes back to bite the Wizards, you know, goes against them with the Russell Westbrook stepping on the out of bounds line. Cause it looks like he had the Sean Elliott foot over the line, you know, going on when you look at it, but a tough possession late in the game doesn't go the Wizards way. And Russ is called out of bounds. Joel Embiid's, you know, gets snagged for these ticky-tacky fouls, these traveling calls that weren't called or were overlooked or what have you. What was your perception being there at the game with the officiating? I know you heard all types of stuff coming from the stands, but what did you see from your perspective, Noah?
Yeah, just a little personal tangent to start is back in the day when I was in high school, I did little league umpiring and thought it was a very, you know, challenging job for a teenage kid, especially because you realize that the job is not just getting the calls right or wrong. It's dealing with the people who, regardless of how well you do, think you're doing a poor job. So I have a lot of empathy for officials and referees across sports because, you know, I mean, in a Little League game, it's just a little bit of chatter. I mean, these guys are dealing with, you know, tens of thousands of fans who in any given moment hate their guts, even if they nail the call. You know, just the fact that the call is against the home team makes them, you know, someone who is despised. So all of that said, no, I didn't think the officiating was great yesterday. I mean, as we talked about, it just, they set a tone early that there were going to be a lot of those ticky-tack calls, and that's just not what you expect from a playoff game. That's not to say that, you know,
they weren't valid. It just was out of the ordinary a bit.
It just seemed tight even for a regular season game, honestly, in some instances. And that's not to say that playoff games should be all, you know, brutal elbows and the whistles should be silent, you know, regardless of the level of contact. But I just think setting that tone at the beginning of the game made things tough on the officials down the line. Like, you know, because one of your most important jobs as a referee is consistency. And well, you know, if that's a call, then why isn't that a call? And, you know, if this, you know, it just opens up a can of worms that you don't want to as someone calling the game. So no, not an excellent job by the officials. Most importantly, it didn't determine the outcome of the game. Like, I think the Wizards would also tell you the Sixers were the better team and the Sixers won, but there were some calls that were wrong on both sides. And, you know, that's the reality of how it was in game one. So we'll see what things are like for the rest of the series.
Yeah. And I'm not going to make it seem like I watched all of every game because I did not. But what I did see, I probably only missed the Clippers game because my daughter had a softball game. But what I did see from all the games I did watch was it was more playoff basketball style with the officiating. With, I mean, of course, fans can point to different things of different teams and what did or didn't go their way, but it was not a tight whistle across many of the other games I saw. I saw a lot of flopping from, I mean, of course, he got, I don't know, of course, but Rudy Gobert, man, on the, but no, the guy's eye is not in the game, and he's getting flopping on the bench, on the baseline. LeBron James flopping from the free throw line, and I guess he thought he was filming Space Jam with all the acting he was doing. But, you know, it's just, you know what? This is my thing. I saw this tweet that went something like this. I'm paraphrasing, but it went something like Kobe and Michael Jordan would be hurt, but want to make you think that they were perfectly fine, where LeBron is perfectly fine, but wants to make you think he's hurt. Like, I thought that was really interesting. But any thoughts or perspectives just on the officiating that you saw outside of the Sixers game, which I thought was more playoff style, and maybe the flopping that just goes on, it's kind of rampant across the league. It's ultra competitive environment, but still.
Yeah, the Gobert flop is one of the most ludicrous things in memory for me in an NBA game. You know, he fouls out, so he's supposed to be on the bench. He strays very far from the bench, you know, gets in someone's face, and he tries
to induce a call.
Sold the heck out of it. I think, like, with flopping, you know, a lot of it's subjective. There are a lot of, like, gray area cases where it's okay. The whole point of the flop is to draw attention to what's a legitimate foul, right? But Rudy Gobert, that's not at all what was happening. That was someone creating and trying to exacerbate drama. And, you know, that's not what the league wants to see. And that's the type of thing that, you know, probably, if you set a precedent there of that being punished, then it happens less down the line. But, you know, this has been the trend in the NBA for a while, that players embellish contact. Joel Embiid is one of them. And part of the reason is that there's a recognition nowadays that free throws are so valuable. Like, you know, one of the most valuable skills a player can have is drawing free throws. Joel Embiid's the best, you know, the best in the world at it. And so that incentivizes flopping. And then when, you know, people get away with flopping and, you know, are very rarely punished for it, or the punishment is just a fine that they don't consider that significant, they see no reason to stop. So I think that's kind of where we're at. And you wonder how much more it can escalate, but the level of flopping in the game nowadays is certainly quite high.
Just to bring it back to the Sixers, you mentioned Joel. He mentioned in a recent interview that part of the reason he has that flopping aspect of his game was from watching soccer players growing up who often try to induce yellow cards, red cards, what have you, a penalty against the other team by, you know, overreacting, exaggerating, those types of things. So you got guys like Gobert, who a Frenchman, Joel Embiid, who, you know, soccer is a global sport, the most popular sport in the world, arguably. So, you know, you see that kind of impact coming to the game. And then, like, I don't know, if you're an American player who probably didn't go out watching, you know, soccer, what would their excuse be? Like, okay, like I grew up watching soccer and that kind of had an impression on me. I can get that. But like LeBron, like what? Like you are Mr. Dominant. Like my dad says, oh, like the big men don't get any calls. So he's trying to show that, you know, he gets beat up so bad and, you know, he wants to induce the calls and, you know, get what he deserves and his just due. For me, though, I think the refs need flop training, bro. It's like guys like LeBron who constantly flop, or maybe Joel also, like, they should be on not like high alert, but do you know this? You don't make the call. It's a flop. Like, you need flop training to recognize the flops, because the refs just get fooled so often when things are just clearly, egregiously at times, overreactions or exaggerations. Like that's what I think. Like they need to, it's less on the players, because like you said, the fines are so minimal. There's an obvious, you know, advantage gained by getting to the free throw line. Like you can't reward people for that type of, you know, forgive the terminology, chicken shit type of, you know, basketball where, you know, like, come on, man, like take the refs out of it. Like it that shouldn't be a part of it. As much as it is.
Yeah, I think it's gotten tougher and tougher on the refs because more and more people are doing it. And you have, honestly, people in the league nowadays who grew up watching LeBron and learned from him and learned some of the tricks of the trade. One thing I'll say on like the soccer player skill, you know, sort of angle of it is in soccer, like if you dive looking for a penalty, like you're going to get a yellow card for that. So it would obviously be a radical change to the NBA's rules to institute some sort of
a tech for flopping.
Maybe the equivalent is a technical, you know, something along those lines.
One shot free throw.
Or even call it like a flagrant, you know, in some cases, maybe, you know, you flailing backward arguably creates a dangerous situation for someone else. But, you know, just some sort of way to be a little harsher.
Yeah, that would nip it in the butt. I think. Because you're bringing all the attention to the flopper.
Exactly. But of course, it's much easier said than done to, you know, make judgments on that because, right. You know, in soccer, there's often a very fine line between, yeah, you know, he did clip his ankle going in for that tackle versus, no, there was basically zero contact there. And that was a flop, you know, they call it a dive in soccer. So one thing that comes to mind, you know, would, if this gets, you know, very, very bad, maybe that's the emergency plan for the NBA is to some sort of measure like that. But, you know, not something we're going to see anytime in the near future. And this is kind of what the game is now in many ways.
LeFlop was trending yesterday on Twitter. LeFlop for LeBron and what that free throw line thing he did, which was just part of like a rumble that happened off camera that we didn't see with Montrezl Harrell. But anyway, man, I don't know what you guys have been doing this past weekend, but you missed a lot of good basketball. But there is a lot more good basketball to come if you had not been locked into the NBA. It has been exciting. It has been fun. 30-point triple-doubles, buzzer beaters, the Knicks game. The Garden is back, bro. The Garden is back. Meaningful playoff basketballs in New York. man, imagine a series between the Knicks and the Sixers and the fan interaction. Like, come on. A little normalcy is back, folks. I hope you're enjoying it. Noah Levick and I definitely will be with you every step of the way here with the Sixers as they return to action Wednesday. A little time off here. Back at it on Wednesday. But we will be with here with you Thursday with the podcast. So for Noah Levick, check out his work on NBCSportsPhiladelphia.com. I'm Danny Pommels. For Ben Berry, our esteemed producer, thanks for listening. This has been Sixers Talk, brought to you by Wilmington University. WilmU Works.